In John chapter 4, Jesus describes the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. Verses 23 and 24. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. Now for the next few minutes, stay tuned to Worship in Spirit and Truth with Pastor Jeff Scoggin.
I want to give a quick disclaimer, really, or retraction, or whatever it wants to be. The last time, I made a statement that the first thing God created was food. It's not really accurate if you take it just that way all by itself, because we know that God created absolutely everything that exists, including the sun, moon, stars, planets, solar systems, everything that's out there before food. So I didn't want to leave anybody misinterpreting what I was. What had struck me was that on the first day and the second day, he had done some things that were a little bit different than what he did on the third day. On the first day, he bestowed his presence upon the earth. On the second day, he separated waters above from waters below. And then he separated the water. He moved the waters out of the way so that dry land could appear. And then he said, let the ground sprout food. And somehow that struck me as a little different than bestowing his presence and moving things around. But anyway, I didn't. I might have said it in a way that confused someone. And if that's the case, sorry for that. God first created the universe and everything that's in it. So anyway, pray with me before we begin. Father in heaven, thank you for your word, and thank you that you have seen fit to give us a description of the beginning and the ways that you created the heavens and the earth. And it's fascinating to see what you have shown to us in that description. I pray that as we look at the fourth and fifth days today, that your word would be clear to us. Speak to each one of our hearts through your word and help us to hear you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. So the last time we explored on the second day of creation how God made this expanse in the midst of the waters so that he could create life within that expanse. And then on the third day he ordered the ground that he brought to appear to sprout vegetation, to serve as food for the creatures that he was going to create next. And that brings us to day number 4. So if you don't have your Bibles open already, open them to Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 14. Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 14. I'll just read the whole fourth day. And God said, let the lights in the expanse of the sky be for separating the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark appointed times and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. On the fourth day of creation, if we're interested in chronological details, we run into some questions. If God created the sun and the moon on the fourth day, how was there day and night on the first and second and third day? Right? We ask that question, and I'll tell you honestly, straight up, that no one can be entirely sure because we weren't there. Only God was there. Remember, the story hasn't been given to us for the purposes of understanding the scientific explanations of behind creation. That's not why God gave us the story. The story was given to us to guide our understanding on multiple levels in the spiritual realm. So the reason that the story was given really needs to count for something. For answering scientific and chronology questions, the story simply doesn't give us enough information to answer all of our questions. Of course, that doesn't stop us from wondering, and it doesn't stop us from seeking clues, and that is why theologians have noted that the language in this verse, in verse 14, is different than the language that we saw in verse 6. In verse 6, the syntax of the wording suggests that God made an expanse where there had been no expanse before. He said, let there be an expanse. In other words, let the expanse come into existence. But in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, rather than saying, let there be lights in the expanse to separate, which is the way that most of our Bibles actually do translate it, it's just as possible for it to be translated, God said, let the lights in the expanse be for separating. You see the small difference there in the way that it is translated? In other words, let the lights that are already in the expanse have the function of separating. You understand? The wording actually suggests that these lights already existed because he had created them at some earlier time. Didn't tell us exactly when, but that he had created them at some earlier time. And on the fourth day, what he did was he assigned their function. And God said, let the lights in the expanse of the sky be for separating day from night. Now we noted in Genesis 1:1 that when the verse says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, there's not exactly enough information to know when that happened. So we don't know if God created our galaxy and our solar system, including the sun, moon, and stars, a long time before the 7 days of creation, or immediately before the 7 days of creation, or on the first day of creation. We simply don't know. But we have noted that the language of the description allows for the possibility that the sun, moon, and stars were created by God at some previous time, and that on the fourth day, he assigned their purpose. In each phrase of these verses, we're going to see a number of times as we go through this that the language is stressing their function rather than the time of their creation. So it's actually going to get a little bit repetitive as we go through. We see it again and again and again. The whole purpose of these lights was for them to separate, mark, and rule the day and the night. When they were created simply isn't the point of the story. It's not what it endeavors to communicate. Rather, their function was the point. What was their function? Verse 14, God said, let the lights in the expanse of the sky be for separating day from night, and let them serve as signs to mark appointed times, days, and years. These lights were assigned the role of being signs for appointed times, days, and years. There's a lot going on underneath the surface here that you might recognize if you're really familiar with the Bible, and you probably won't recognize if you don't. The words used for signs and appointed times in Hebrew are special words. These are unique and special words used usually for Israel's rituals. These words, combined with other terms that we will see, makes it clear that we should recognize the connection between the fourth day of creation and the Old Testament sanctuary rituals that we're going to read later about in Exodus and Leviticus. We're not going to get there today, of course. But there's a connection between these words and these very important terms that are connected with the Old Testament sanctuary and the rituals assigned with it. Signs, the word for signs, is the same word in Genesis 17:11 for the sign of circumcision, interestingly enough. It's also the same the word that is used in Exodus 12 for the sign of the blood on the doorpost at Passover. Remember that? And then also in Ezekiel 20, it's used for the sign of the Sabbath. And the word used for appointed times and seasons, more than merely indicating just the four seasons, summer, winter, spring, fall, it also refers in the Old Testament to meeting with God. In fact, the same word is used for the tent of meeting and the assemblies and the feasts. Okay? So you can already just get a glimpse that there's a lot more going on underneath the surface here than what we might first see. The implications of this verse, then, if we had time to trace them through, are really quite mind-blowing. There's a lot going on here. God was setting things up. Even at creation, God knew and was planning for all that was going to happen on the planet. He had foreseen it all. He knew that Adam and Eve would rebel. He knew that the sanctuary services and all that went with them was going to be needed. He knew that he was going to have to die on a cross and make incredible sacrifices for his creation. So here, in the very beginning, before any of it happened, God was establishing the necessary framework to deal with the sin problem that Satan was already promoting among the angels in heaven. We are seeing here that God designed creation itself with all of this in mind. Because he assigned the lights in the sky to be signs for future appointed times that would be connected to all that he knew that he would have to do. Pretty amazing, isn't it? I hope no one here is ever tempted to think that God was blindsided by the problem of sin. Clearly, he was not. Verse 14. God said, "Let the lights in the expanse of the sky be for separating the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark appointed times, days, and years. And let them be lights in the sky, in the expanse of the sky, to give light on the earth." And it was so. So again, the purpose of these lights in the heavens was to give light on the earth. These lights, of course, are the sun and moon. But the passage seems to purposely avoid identifying them by name. Interesting. Remember that God had already named things in creation. He had named day and night, and he had named land and sea, and later more things are going to be named. He has Adam name all the animals, for instance. And we're familiar with the importance of names in Scripture. And when God changes people's names, how important that is. So in all of the things that one might expect in creation for God to name, it would be the sun and moon. In fact, it would be perfectly natural for the verse to say, "And God named the greater light sun, and the lesser light he named moon." But he didn't. It's not there. Why not? It might well be that God avoided naming the sun and moon on purpose, because he knew the future, that people would take these heavenly bodies and assign godlike qualities to them. They would turn them into their own gods. The sun and moon became so closely connected with paganism, and they had assigned divinity to them, that the very absence of their names in this passage seems to be a protest against those beliefs. In other words, the fact that the name of the sun and moon are not used acted as a deafening silence in the account of creation to anyone who might be tempted to worship the sun and the moon. This verse, then, and the following repetition, makes it clear that the function of these lights was nothing more than to light the earth and to serve as signs to mark time. That was it. Nothing more, absolutely no godlike qualities to them. Verse 16, God had made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. Again, the construction of this phrase suggests the sun and moon themselves were not created on the fourth day, but rather their function was assigned as ruling the day and the night. The phrase actually can be legitimately translated, God had made the two great lights. That's a perfectly legitimate translation of that verse. And again, even though Hebrew has specific words for sun and moon, they seem to purposely have been avoided here, calling them literally two great luminaries. The Hebrew word is ma'or.
which is an interesting word because the only other place that that root is used in the Bible is for the menorah in the Old Testament sanctuary. Interesting. This is a strong clue that there is a lot more meaning that's underlying these lights than the surface first reading implies. The greater light was going to rule the day, the lesser light would rule the night. Now, the word for rule here is an important word for our understanding some critical passages in the story later. Rule. This is the same root word used in Genesis 3:16, where God told Eve that Adam was going to rule over her. And in Genesis 4:6, where God told Cain that sin is crouching at your door and you must rule over it. There's a lot of interesting interpretations that go along with this word rule, and I am not going to take a stroll through that minefield today. But I can tell you that connecting this verse with those later passages significantly affects the way that we understand the meaning behind them in a positive way. God had made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. It's kind of an interesting way that the sentence is structured. It's separated, right? There's a reason. Here again, the function of the stars or the time of their creation is not supplied in the text. The information stands alone. Extra information. Therefore, the text is not necessarily saying that they were created on the fourth day. It's only mentioning that the stars also rule the night by providing light. That's all it was saying. Verse 17, God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, or God had set them in the expanse of the sky. The primary meaning of the Hebrew word for put or set has to do with giving or bestowing something. So here, once again, the emphasis is not on God physically placing the lights in the expanse on the fourth day, but rather his gifting them to the earth at that time. Verse 18, they are to govern the day and the night and to separate light from darkness, and God saw that it was good. The purpose of God gifting these lights to creation was, again, to rule the day and the night. The repetition gives us the impression that the concept of ruling must be important, which it is. Indeed, it helps us to understand in the rest of the Bible what it means when God refers to ruling. The other reason that God gifted these lights into the earth was to separate light from darkness. In Genesis 1:4, when God created light, he did it for the same reason, to separate light from darkness. Perhaps the best way to understand the parallels here is that the sun and the moon function as an ongoing metaphor for God's function in the universe of separating light from darkness, right from wrong. God is the standard. He is the thing that makes that separation. So every time that you see a sunrise, be reminded of the way that God bestows his light, his presence upon us. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. Then verse 20. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth, across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the waters in the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. The fifth day of creation, God spoke life into the spaces that he opened up on the second day by putting fish in the water and birds in the expanse of the heavens. Now, this was not the first life that God had created. On the third day, he had created living vegetation. So maybe you've wondered, like I have, how is that going to work in the new earth? You ever ask yourself this question? I like woodworking. Right? Building with wood, but that requires cutting down trees. Isn't cutting grass and pruning branches in a way a kind of killing part of something? I think the Bible's description of the first day of creation compared to the third day of creation helps us to answer some of those questions. On the fifth day, God created living creatures and birds, while on the third day, he created living vegetation. But evidently, as we'll see, Living vegetation and living creatures are two different forms of life. I mean, I don't really have to tell you that. It's in a way, it's obvious, but it also shows up here in the text. The trees and the plants were given for food. Therefore, picking fruit, obviously, even though you're going to eat it and throw away the core, or pruning a vine, or cutting a tree, is not the same thing as killing a living creature, or also known as a living soul, as it's sometimes translated. I don't know if you've ever noticed this. The Hebrew word for living creature is sometimes translated living soul, and it's an accurate translation. Here it's used to describe fish and birds, and it's also used to describe the creation of Adam and Eve. When God created them, they became chaya nefesh, living souls. Now, it's commonly believed that the soul and the body are two separate things. The soul is immortal, the body is mortal, and when the body dies, the soul goes on living, right? You ask most people on the street, that's what they're going to understand. But if that were really the case, then according to this verse, the same is true for all living creatures. Not only are there immortal human souls, but there are immortal dog souls, and immortal cat souls, and grasshopper souls, and slug souls, and immortal mosquito and tick souls. How do you like that? What this verse indicates, along with other verses that later describe Adam's creation, is that God created the creatures and gave them life, and that's how they became living creatures. That's how they became living souls. In other words, it is when God created the body and combined with that body the life that He bestows on it, that is what creates a living soul. I've heard somebody use the illustration of a box. All right, you have some pieces of wood and you have some nails. And you put these two things together to form a box. Now, if you take it back apart, where did the box go? It ceases to exist because the two together is what makes it exist. It's a fairly good illustration, I think, of the way that the body and the soul work. Remove life from the body and the soul ceases to exist, except for in the memory of God. The whole notion that the body and soul are separate doesn't come from the Bible, by the way, in case you didn't know that. It comes from the ancient Greek philosopher Plato. He's really the one that popularized this idea. The fact that the body with life in it is the soul has huge implications for much of the way that we understand life and death. And maybe we can look at that more deeply when we study creation of human beings at another time. Let's go on to verse 20. God said, "Let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky." And so God created. That I want to stop at that word created for a minute. Except for the Genesis 1:1, the very first verse, "In the beginning God created." The fifth day is the first time that that word is used again in the story. Created, bara in Hebrew. Bara carries the connotation of shaping or cutting or forming more than the generic words that have been used before, like make or be or appear or sprout or rule. All of those verbs are different than bara, all of which are used in these previous days. When God created, commanded light to be, it didn't say He created light, it said He commanded light to be, the expanse to be made, land to appear, the luminaries to be signs and to rule, and the ground to sprout. All wonderful verbs, but they're not create. The word created was used to describe overall creation in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and then evidently the word was reserved for the fifth day again, to be used again on the fifth day and the sixth days. So again, we're seeing a difference being made between God's creation of the things that support the lives of living creatures and the living creatures themselves. God said, "Let the waters teem with living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky." So God created the great creatures, tanin, the great creatures of the sea. And translators have struggled with this word. Some translate the word as whale. Some translate it as great sea creatures, some as great sea monsters, and it's actually those that choose great sea monsters or great sea serpents that are the closest, the most accurate translations. So these great sea monsters, these sea serpents, Tanin, were the stars, by the way, in ancient myths. I started to read some of them and look through some of the myths behind some of these great sea monsters, and it's pretty fantastic what people have come up with. As I was talking about at the children's story, right? They continued to be feared well into the time of Columbus, whom they feared would either sail off the edge of the earth or would be eaten by one of these great sea serpents that they believed lurked far out into the oceans. This whole idea of sea serpents first came from the Bible. So when they were drawing these maps for Christopher Columbus, they were quoting the Bible. God created these things, these ancient sea monsters. And the fact that the Bible uses this specific term, Tanin, however, seems to go deeper than the mythology, because the Bible itself, in Isaiah 27:1, connects the sea monster, the same word, Tanin, with Leviathan, the serpent, the dragon, the symbol of Satan. This opens up a whole can of worms, doesn't it? In Genesis 3, we're going to see the first encounter with this deadly serpent when it tempts Eve to eat the forbidden fruit. This mention of serpents of the sea is a sort of preemptive piece of information to inform us that this creature, as strong and terrible as it may sound, was nothing more than a fish created by God. Now, this does not mean that Satan was created on the fifth day of creation, nor does it mean that God created some evil creatures in the sea on the fifth day of creation. No, what we have here is a veiled hint described on the fifth day of creation that this monster that we are going to be encountering, this terrible, frightening, powerful serpent of the sea that we are going to see later, is still nothing more than a fish created by God. When he's your enemy, the sea serpent is your enemy, that's a pretty comforting idea to know that as bad as it is, it's still nothing more than a fish created by God. The thing is that God created this sea serpent as something good in the beginning. He created it good in the beginning. It says at the end, and God saw that it was good. And when he created it, it was. We can read the story in more detail in the book of Ezekiel, where it talks about the guardian cherub that God had created perfect in all things until evil was found in his heart. It was sin that transformed this serpent into something evil. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great sea monsters and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. It was good. And thus God created the first living creatures of the earth. He appreciated and he found joy in what he had created. But unlike on the other days, God went one step further with these creatures. Verse 22, God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the waters and the seas and let birds increase on the earth. This is the first of two blessings that God pronounced in what he created. On the previous days, he found his creation good, but he didn't pronounce any special blessings on them. Living creatures, on the other hand, are valuable to God in a way that is different than other parts of his creation. The blessing that God pronounced on them was to be fruitful and to multiply. Life was given the ability to create more life that also has the breath of God in it. Just think about the awesomeness of that idea. Only God is capable of giving life. Science, as hard as it is trying to create life, will never succeed. Because only God is capable of creating and bestowing life. And yet, he gave living creatures the ability to give birth and to create life. We should be much more amazed by this blessing than we are. There's a lot more we could explore in this idea of God telling the creatures to be fruitful and multiply, but we're going to have to save that for another time. Let's just read through it one more time. Verse 14. And God said, "Let the lights in the expanse of the sky be for separating the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great luminaries, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God had set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth, across the expanse of the sky." So God created the great monsters of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged creature according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. I don't know about you, but I can't read the story of creation anymore quite the same way, because some of these things now leap out at me as having so much more underneath. Amen.
Thank you for joining Pastor Jeff Scoggins today for Worship in Spirit and Truth. We would love to hear your thoughts about the program, and your financial support is also greatly appreciated so that we can continue bringing you these kinds of programs. Tell your friends they can find the program Spirit and Truth right here on this station. Stay tuned for contact information and more details from your local station to follow. Until next time, keep your mind fixed on Jesus.